There was a time when the typical Iowa kitchen table would creak under the weight of meat and potatoes, homegrown vegetables, and milk from the family cow. Times have changed, and so has our understanding of nutrition. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we're exploring different aspects of Iowa then and now. This hour, food and nutrition. I'll talk with Teresa Carberry, one of the founding members of New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City, Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University, and Jan Miller, Executive Food Editor at Better Homes and Gardens. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we're exploring different aspects of Iowa then and now. At noon on River to River today, we'll talk about mental health and childhood diseases. This hour, food and nutrition then and now. The way we eat has changed dramatically over the decades, and what we know about food and nutrition is constantly changing. Later this hour, I'll talk with Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition for Iowa State University, and Jan Miller, Executive Food Editor at Better Homes and Gardens. We also want to hear from you this hour. How has your diet changed over the years? How is it different from what your grandparents used to put on the table? Do you remember your first experience with ethnic food in Iowa? That used to be a lot harder to come by. We want to hear your stories this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to start the hour with a story that takes place during the early days of the health food movement. Teresa Carberry and friends started a buyer's club that eventually became New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City. And Teresa is here with me today. Hello, Teresa.
Hi there, Cherry. Thank you for hosting me today.
Well, thank you for being here. Now, take us back to the very beginning. What, this is the late 1960s?
That's right. And there were a group of people who were looking at a larger cultural movement that asks, just how naturally are we interacting with our environment? What is our diet like? And they looked and they saw their diet was predominantly refined and preserved, processed foods, and they also associated poor health and degradation of the environment and even social injustice associated with that. And being the idealist of that era, why they decided to do better and decided that they would eliminate white flour, white sugar, hydrogenated fats, coffee even, and meat. So with almost religious zeal, this group decided to be a vegetarian and to find whole, unprocessed foods.
Now, of course, you could have your own gardens and get food that way, but it was really hard to find the other kinds of foods you were looking for, right?
Well, there was a great emphasis, of course, on brown rice and all the grains and all the beans. And that was sort of the mainstay of the diet at that time, including, believe it or not, sea vegetables. There was whole, practically whole classes on all the different sea vegetables and what you could do with them. Nuts and, you know, nut butters were all very popular and healthful oils.
Where were you getting your information?
Well, there seemed to be just a wealth of information available through sort of a network of savvy people trying to look to a more whole diet for whole health, for whole people raised in a wholesome way with more environmentally sound production practices.
And there were a few books that had come out that really...
Well, the Rodale Press had a lot of ideas, and it was the hippie era, and there was just a wealth of information and sharing. It was a culture that believed that we could do better, and we had hustle and youthful vigor.
So, all right, you could get the information, you could share books, you could look at newsletters, magazines, that kind of thing. Where did you get the food?
Well, that's what's interesting about a cooperative. A cooperative is formed to meet a need which is not being addressed by the larger market. So in this case, as in most cases with a co-op, people came together to meet a shared need. And so we could purchase a 50-pound bag of brown rice, say, and meet in the basement of one of the local churches, each bring our own bags, bottles, and jars. We had this absolutely antique scale, and we would all break down the on a given night the 50-pound bag of rice and put the money in a cigar box. And this was happening then over time with all the grains and all the beans and the peanut butter and the oil. And it became a breakdown party for the buying club, and it was in the basement of Wesley House once a month.
All right. And people would just bring their own containers, and you'd break it up, and the scales seemed to be fairly accurate.
Yeah. We were proud of being ecologically sound and minimizing packaging waste way back then.
So where were you ordering the food from?
Well, there was a warehouse in Minneapolis, and it was like one step ahead of us. But there was great joy and great challenges in the food and in the distribution. I remember there were challenges, for example, with the honey. It would stiffen right up, and it would be almost impossible to distribute. The peanut butter, of course, being natural peanut butter. We didn't want the hydrogenated kind. All the oil would come to the top, and all the solids would go to the bottom. Then, as now, the challenge, you have to turn that out into a giant bowl and stir it. That was like athletic. And of course, the whole wheat flour has that nutritious bit of germ ground up in it, and so it has to be consumed fairly shortly after it's ground or kept refrigerated. So we had our share of challenges.
And was there a learning curve for people who joined the group as far as learning to prepare these foods? Because, of course, if you're used to working with all-purpose flour, working with whole wheat flour that still has the wheat germ, and that's a very different kind of process.
Well, the emphasis on grains and beans, the idea that you had to plan ahead, like you had to soak the beans the night before, then you had to simmer them for an hour and a half. Like this is, and then only then did you have like the product that you could then start to cook with. Then you would saute the onions and add the spice. It required some planning ahead.
Now, I remember during some of those years, and I was very young during as this was going on. I remember from the mid-70s, I remember there was an emphasis on combining proteins in the right way and that kind of thing. As you were learning these things and adjusting to these things, can you think of something that used to be gospel in the movement that later on you're like, I can't believe we spent that much time worrying about that?
Well, I think that there was a great deal of emphasis on cheese and a great deal of emphasis on nutritional yeast. And I do still eat cheese, but I don't eat anywhere near the amount of cheese that I used to. So I think that as we look at trends in the food industry or in people's personal diets, it's sort of like waves breaking on the beach, and each wave can teach us something if we're paying attention. So that early wave breaking on the beach of the natural foods dawning was to help us get away from processed foods. And certainly looking at all these whole grains, I mean, people had no idea what to do with a whole grain. They might have eaten white bread their whole life, but then when they saw a wheat berry, they had no idea. They thought it was something a horse would eat. And even if they enjoyed bean dip, they didn't know how to cook a bean. It was like a little marble or a rock. I mean, so cooking from scratch or knowing what the whole food source was, that was an insight. And as we move through understanding how much fat is in stuff and where the calories are in fat, that was an insight. But then when we looked at percentage of calories from fat, to bring that down, they dumped in all the white sugar. So, and when we look at carbohydrates, are carbohydrates evil? No. Carbohydrates are good if they're whole foods, not refined. So now, again, we're seeing how the refined carbohydrates are sort of betraying us as empty calories.
So as your buyer's group grew, how big did it get before you thought, we can't keep doing this in the basement?
Well, it got up to about 40 or 50 people, which was really beyond what we could manage. Then we started having sort of a backlog of product, and we started building up a stash and then moved to our 518 Bowery. And with that building still stands now as a pasta shop, and opened the doors to everyone. But it was a pretty intimidating place if you weren't already in with the in crowd. And it was sort of a social circle. It was very supportive and fun. I remember at one point that people still craved sweets, as people
and we
will.
Still do, right?
And of course, the sensible thing, we'd have a nice piece of fresh fruit. But people, I remember craving cake. So you had whole wheat flour and honey. And it's pretty darn hard because honey doesn't have the properties of sugar, and whole wheat flour is not like cake flour. And I remember trying to make a cake, and we brought it out of the oven, and my friend and I, our eyes met, and we kind of went, oh, because it was like not really like a cake. It was kind of pitiful. And then we said, back to the, we should have some fruit. I remember a person looking at some dried apricots, and these dried apricots were exciting. Of course, then as now, you can simmer your dried apricots in a little orange juice or leave them overnight in the orange juice. And they were tossing their fingers through the dried apricots going, I'm rich, as though they were coins, rejoicing in this concentrated sweet, a natural sweet we got to have.
We, my mother was part of one of these buyers clubs in the mid-1970s, and I remember she got really excited about carob for a while and would bring home carob and try to make me eat cookies that had carob in them. And carob is not chocolate, no matter how you prepare it. So there were some misadventures like that.
Yeah, I think carob – well, carob I think is a food unto itself, but it's not chocolate. It really isn't.
So now in your experience, I mean, in your lifetime and in your career, not only have you gone from this buyer's club in the basement to New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City, which of course now has three different locations and you know, so much food available on the shelves, an incredible amount of variety. But you also now live in a world where health foods, whole foods are available at almost every grocery store. And the information continues to develop about nutrition, and tastes continue to change, and trends continue to change. But it's so easy to get your hands on such a variety of food today. Do you remember when that shift started to happen?
Well, it took a really, really long time for the rest of the grocery industry to notice that the only growth was occurring in fresh, local, natural, and organic. They just kept dismissing this section of the grocery industry. But, of course, we were seeing tremendous growth. But I'm happy because my whole life could be summarized professionally as, like, eat your vegetables. And now people get it. And there's a great variety of ways to present them. And the children are eating their vegetables. And vegetables are growing in the schoolyards. And it's a great success for the vegetables and sustainably produced proteins and meat. And they taste better and they're more cleanly produced. So that's really the meats and seafood you want to choose.
Well, and people now seem to have I mean, there are people who will only eat organic and pursue some of the early principles that you're talking about with this health food movement. But now most people mix and match and have some of these whole grains and some of the other. Is that exciting for you to see that this is part of mainstream culture?
Yeah, it's great. And I'm willing to go anywhere and steal ideas from any restaurant. Sometimes I'll go to a restaurant, look at the menu and get ideas like, I should do that at home. And so just take the money and spend it at the grocery store and take it home and make it.
Well, Teresa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
Teresa Carbery, she's one of the founding members of New Pioneer Food Co-op in Iowa City. This hour, we're talking about food and nutrition then and now in Iowa, and we do want to hear your stories. So please join us. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This week is Iowa Week. We are spending the whole week on Talk of Iowa and River to River talking about Iowa then and now. And this hour, we're focusing on food and nutrition. And as someone who grew up in Iowa, I can clearly remember the first time I had Chinese food, the first time I had Indian food. Food options have changed dramatically over the years with globalization and awareness. And this hour, we are talking about some of those changes. We also want to hear your stories, your comments, your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Ruth Litchfield is with me now. She's an associate professor of food science and human nutrition at Iowa State University. Hello, Ruth.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And let's start with talking about nutrition guidelines. I mean, we were just sort of focusing on those early days of the health food movement. When did the first nutrition guidelines come out from the federal government?
Well, the federal government released the dietary guidelines, as they're referred to as the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Those first came out in 1980. And these are the federal nutrition policy, and this is done jointly by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Health and Human Services. And these guidelines are basically what's the nutrition recommendations for Americans ages 2 and older. And keeping in mind, In 2010, our most current version of the dietary guidelines, for the first time, they addressed prevention of chronic disease. Prior to that, it was promotion of, overall health. Well, we now realize we've got some chronic diseases that have some very significant relationships with nutrition. And so now the dietary guidelines are actually encompassing, what are those recommendations that we have to prevent a lot of the chronic diseases that we're experiencing as a country now as well. Originally, when the dietary guidelines came out, these were targeted towards the consumer. So it was a very simple, small brochure aimed at consumers and trying to increase their awareness of, what are the recommendations. And they were based on the opinions from an expert panel that came together. So leading researchers in various areas of nutrition were brought together to put together these recommendations. So the first four iterations were really geared towards the consumers. In 2000, however, there was a little bit of a shift in the dietary guidelines, and it was not just a consumer-oriented piece, but also now it was more of a policy document, and that was aimed at those who really do a lot of nutrition education. So nutrition educators, dietitians, those who work with the consumers and better understanding the science behind the recommendations that were being made. And then our last two dietary guidelines have been solely a policy document, so really aimed at the educators, the nutritionists, the dietitians, the policymakers that needed that science to really serve as the foundation for their work. And so, again, it's a panel that's pulled together, but it's shifted more towards a policy document. And in the most recent iteration, the 2010, this is the first time that the dietary guidelines use the USDA Nutrition Evidence Library. So it's a real systematic, evidence-based review of all of the literature out there. What is the most rigorous research we have that's been done with an appropriate methodology, appropriate statistics, so that we can really make the recommendations based on the science? What is research telling us? But the dietary guidelines are really important because this is the basis of all federal nutrition policy, education, outreach, the food assistance programs, including SNAP, the school lunch program, the WIC program. So this report really guides a lot of that policy.
And it has changed a lot over the years. It also is something I feel like it garners more and more attention almost every time there is a policy change. Was it as controversial when it was first introduced?
When it was first introduced, I think there's always been controversy along the way, because back then, keep in mind, we didn't have this evidence analysis library this plethora of research to really base it on the science. And so, sometimes it could have been considered more of an opinion rather than based on fact. But I think there's always been controversy, but it's becoming more pronounced as research base is growing, and the research base can actually, be controversial in and of itself. I think what might be more controversial is the graphic that goes with it, because I'm sure a lot of people remember the original pyramid that came out back in the early 90s. We had the food guide pyramid that came out, and we had the blocks, the various blocks of the pyramid. And that pyramid still had pictures of food on it. And so I think that one, was pretty well received by consumers, and still had the pictures of food on there, and they kind of understood the concept behind it. However, as science evolved and we knew that it didn't quite represent exactly the message we were trying to convey, they switched the pyramid to more of these vertical lines. We found that really did not resonate well with both consumers, and actually professionals had a lot of concerns about it because there were no foods shown on the pyramid. And so now we have MyPlate. And, the real drive behind MyPlate was to make a graphic representation of the dietary guidelines in a simple consumer message that resonates with consumers. So having it on a plate and displaying the proportionality of the food groups, we're hopeful that resonates well. It seems to so far. We always know there's room for improvement, but I think we're making progress.
Well, I want to talk with you more about some of the changes that you've observed over the years as well. But I also want to bring somebody else into the conversation now who has an inside view of how food has changed over time. And she even influences some of those changes as the editor of the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, which was first published in 1930. Jan Miller is here with us now. Hi, Jan. Jan, can you hear me? Jan's with us from Des Moines.
Hi, how are you?
There you are. Hi, Jan.
Good.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me into the conversation.
Well, and like I said with Ruth, I want to talk about some of your observations over time. But, you know, I know that you came back into Iowa in 1997 and you've spent a lot of time with these cookbooks and making changes over time. But when you kind of get the big picture and looking at those early Better Homes and Gardens cookbooks, and now, what are some of the shifts that you've seen?
You know, it is so fun. I often go back and dip into the first edition and before it was Red Plaid and the 1930 edition. And they gave such wonderful, sound advice to the head of the household. And they, you know, encouraged her to feed her family 2 servings of vegetables besides a potato, 2 servings of fruit, a moderate amount of meat, or meat substitute, or 1 egg, and then breads, cereals, and starchy vegetables sort of to complete the menu, and some milk. And, you know, it's so funny because we can almost go right back to that today. I mean, we've almost come full circle. When I did my first revision of the Red Plaid cookbook, we had looked at some of the 1970s editions, and you know, the mainstream message was to no fat, low fat, no cholesterol, low sodium, and that book really reflected that, took that to heart entirely. And as we started to test those recipes and compare with some new that we wanted to add to the book, it was so noticeable that there was no flavor. And we all know that even if, you know, we told people that a stick and a piece of bread was good for you, if it didn't taste good, it wasn't going to carry the message. And so today I feel like we've come back full circle, and we like to communicate more of the value add message. It's like there are so many wonderful good foods that are good for you. Let's show you how to add them to your diet and to prepare them in a way that your family will embrace and enjoy.
Well, and Ruth, I know that that's one of the changes that a lot of us have noticed. I mean, butter was everywhere in early Iowa, and then there was this shift. Margarine was so much healthier yeah. for you than butter, and now we're back to butter.
Yeah. And I think that really speaks volumes about the emerging science of nutrition. As far as the sciences go, nutrition is one of the, you know, newer sciences, and we are still learning so much. And, you know, as the research comes out, we are trying to make adjustments accordingly. And, you know, Jan hit it, that fat message was one of the big ones where I think that as the science evolved, we realized we had missed the mark, that, you know, fat was not the culprit for every ailment and every issue that we were experiencing as a society, and that, you know, no fat, low fat, cholesterol free really took on a life of its own. And we're now backing back off of that and saying, okay, well, fat does serve a role in the diet, both nutritionally and from a flavors perspective. And we're finding that it's more, you know, the types of fat, and, you know, you don't want to go overboard on anything. And I think that was another key message that Jan had, is way back in the 30s, they were talking about moderation. And that's something that as a society, we're having a real challenge with, is understanding what is moderation.
And so, moderation is not our thing.
Yes. But with the fat message, it's the moderation, you know, not going overboard on the fat and focusing on the types of fats rather than the no fat, zero fat, you know, fat free. That is one of those messages that we have seen as significant. We went there, and now we've come back from that message. You know, carb-free was another message that was out there for a while, that, you know, you needed to go on a low-carb, no-carb diet. We've all heard of those as well. And so, unfortunately, I think a lot of us are looking for that quick fix. And if we could just key in on that word of moderation and variety, that's really the key, and it sounds like they had that back in the 30s.
Well, and Ruth, we were talking about how those nutrition guidelines from the federal government have changed over time, but of course, nutrition research is going on all the time on a lot of different levels, and we devour that as a public in the media. So
yes.
These, you know, the no-carb diets were everywhere for a while, and there are people who still follow those diets or the low-carb diets. And we've seen recent research come out saying, oh, wait, you know, you can actually lose as much weight with a low-fat diet, that kind of thing. As a nutritionist, watching this happen on the public stage, in the media, how do you feel about that? Because I feel like some of those messages really get twisted.
Yes. Well, and as you mentioned early on, you said something to the effect that, you know, policy has changed or the nutrition guidelines from the federal government have changed over time. And that's because our issues have changed. So if you go back to the start of the school lunch program in the late 40s, the school lunch program was initiated because they were finding that many of the drafts and the recruits in the war were nutritionally deficient. They were not able and well to be good functioning soldiers because of nutrition, poor nutrition intake and lack of nutrient availability. And so the school lunch program actually was to fight nutritional deficiencies. Well, as we have progressed, we've done pretty well at addressing nutrition deficiencies, and now we're addressing chronic diseases as a result of overconsumption on the other end of the spectrum. So the problems have changed, and so therefore some of the guidelines and the policy have changed, you know, as it relates to that. The other thing, as you mentioned, research is constantly coming out. And the concern is that a lot of times, you know, we'll grasp onto one particular piece of research and, oh, this particular study showed that the low-carb diet was more effective in weight loss and keeping that weight off. But yet it was only one study. You know, what was the subject pool? How long were they on this? How long did they follow up with these subjects? Unfortunately, a lot of times these fads are really the result of just one or two, a very few select studies, when we really need to look at all of the research. And that's why in the most recent dietary guidelines, where they used the evidence analysis library through the USDA, where it has a structured process of going through all of the research and only all the research that really has that good integrity and rigor to the analysis and the methodology, that's what we're basing our recommendations on, rather than one select study that, you know, seems to be pretty intriguing.
We're talking about food and nutrition then and now in Iowa, and we've got a couple of people who want to join in the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Madison is on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Madison.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I want to talk a little bit about ethnic food. A friend of mine is a first generation is the correct term, immigrant from China, from South Central China, and his parents make Chinese food for us every once in a while. And Chinese food, as I grew up with it, was a treat, and it was fantastic. But it was so sweet. And the Chinese food that his parents, who actually came from China, make is so different. I mean, both kinds are very good. But I think it's important to note that the quote-unquote ethnic food that Iowa is exposed to isn't necessarily reflective of how the ethnic food itself is actually made in its home country.
Well, I'm sure that is absolutely true. And there does seem to be a recent trend to having more authentic restaurant options as well, although when I was a kid, Chinese food was pretty rare, Ruth.
Yes. I remember, I think I must have been, somewhere in the age 8 to 10. This was quite some time ago, back in the 70s, and heading to the Southwest for a family vacation and having the first introduction to a taco down in Arizona. And it was like, oh, my goodness, where did this come from?
This is good, right? Yeah, we actually have an email on that subject. This is from Maeve. She says, my first Mexican food came from the local grocery store in Tipton. It was like a kit to make tacos with a seasoning mix, and the tacos and instructions were there, too. We made tacos for a campfire meeting, so it must have been an ethnic experience. And then she also says, Chinese food came in a can, Chongqing, I think.
Yeah.
It was chop suey and had dried noodles on top. We ate that at home, and I loved it. And she says, if we wanted pizza, that came out of a box, too.
Yeah, we've come a long way from those days, haven't we?
Absolutely. I mean, Jan, do you have memories of that when you were a kid?
Yes, I do believe the Chongqing in the can was in my mother's cupboard as well, complete with Chinese noodles. But I would agree. It's so wonderful that we have made such inroads. There are so many great places, even in Des Moines, that are working so hard to bring us really, truly authentic flavors. And that is what our consumers are loving right now.
Well, and it's funny, Maeve mentions pizza. And, I mean, that was when I was a kid. Now, basically, we think of that as an American food, but it was not nearly as common or easy to find.
No.
And it was Italian, supposedly.
Well, and I think the one comment that came in, I think it was from Tipton, Iowa, as far as, or maybe it was the other one. Anyway, that the ethnic food that we're getting here in the state is not always the traditional ethnic food. And, you know, we need to be careful about that because really consumer demand is what drives what is being produced, whether it's ethnic foods, whether it's by the big food companies, whether it's by the local grocery store, the local restaurants, is that really our demand is what drives what they're going to provide and offer to us. And we need to keep that in mind that we're really driving the food availability that we have, what's being produced.
Right. Well, of course, The demand was also for what we knew. So if you tried a very Americanized version of Chinese food and that's all you knew and you loved it, that's what you wanted
to
eat too. So we do continue to see that evolution. We're talking about food and nutrition in Iowa then and now as Iowa Week continues. Ruth Litchfield is here, Associate Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University, and Jan Miller, who's Executive Food Editor with Better Homes and Gardens Special Interest Publications, the editor of the Better Homes and Gardens Cookbook. We'd love to hear from you as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As Iowa Week continues, we're exploring many different aspects of Iowa then and now. And this hour, it's food and nutrition. With me is Jan Miller. She is the editor of the Better Homes and Gardens Cookbook. Also with me, Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University. And you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Diana is on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Diana.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Hi. Yeah. Well, I was a child of the 80s, and I grew up, with the food pyramid. And I also grew up with a lot of weight issues. And also with a lot of anxiety and depression, body image issues. I tried the low fat fad. Everyone told me low fat, low fat, low fat. You'll lose weight. I gained weight. I also really messed up my female reproductive system doing the low fat diet. And I started doing the low carb fad. Now that was too short term. I still eat a moderately low carb diet, but what I understood kind of as I've grown into my 30s, that I'm now going to be 32 in October, is that, food quality is the most important. So I know some of your guests pointed out the quality of fat, and that has just been so important in my mental health and also in my reproductive health. To really get a normal menstrual cycle as a female, I don't think it's emphasized enough the importance of quality of fat, especially saturated fat, and cholesterol for the brain. And as I've, grown into my learning, I'm going back to a lot of those roots that are in, the 1930s cookbook. That's what I kind of go to, and I'm involved in a lot of organizations in the Des Moines area that go back to the root and the traditional preparation of food, soaking and fermenting. Fermenting has been huge for me, and also getting an animal that's sustainably sourced, that's local, it doesn't require a lot of petroleum products, that's fed, a healthy diet, and understanding that what goes into the food that I eat also impacts my health. And I don't think, and I do respect the USDA, but I kind of think that there's a conflict of interest there as far as who is telling us what food guidelines and then also where the food comes from. And I don't think there's enough emphasis on local, sustainable food, and rather than how much, food that comes from 200 miles away and what kind of nutrition that has, because for me, it has just made a huge difference in my mental health and my physical health and my, you know, my emotional health.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for sharing your journey, and I'm so glad you found something that is really working for you today. And that is one of the major trends that we see right now. And Ruth, there is, scientifically, there is something about the nutritional value of fruits and vegetables that have traveled a long way or in storage a long time, as opposed to something that is fairly local, right?
Well, and there is this growing interest from consumers wanting to know where their food was produced and where did their food come from. And, you know, if something is produced locally and it's harvested at its optimum ripeness and it's handled correctly post-harvest, you know, that is likely to be more flavorful and have a higher nutritional value than something that was, let's say, picked 2 to 3 weeks post or pre when it's really mature. So, you know, some of our produce is actually picked before it's really truly ripe, because then the ripening process is completed during the transportation. And so when that happens, if it's not handled appropriately post-harvest and that it is not put under those conditions to optimize that continued ripening process, you can potentially have a product that's going to be less nutritional value. It may not taste as good. So, you know, picking it at its optimum maturity, you know, is going to actually make it much more likely that you're going to have that high quality tasting and some high nutritional value product. That's not to say that something that is transported has no nutritional value. It's just because of the transit time and, you know, there's a lot of variables in how it was handled. You know, there's the potential that you could have some deficit, whether it be in the taste or the nutritional quality.
Well, and Jan, you with the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, Diana pointed out that so many of these trends toward diets and weight loss were all about cutting something out, cutting something out entirely. And you've observed, and something that is reflected in your cookbook is more along the lines of exactly what Diana was talking about, adding things in, more of a value-added approach, right?
Absolutely. And I'm loving the conversation about fat right now because, you know, we are looking at, there are some great sources of good fats. And so it is beneficial to put those back in our diet. And I think, in fact, in the last edition of our Red Plaid Cookbook, we took out all those tags that were low fat. And the only nutritional tag that we hung over any individual recipes throughout the book was low calorie, to identify some of those things that maybe were lower calorie if people were being cautious about their overall portion sizes and what they were eating in terms of calories. But we are trying to add, in fact, in the vegetables chapter, it used to just be vegetables in the old cookbooks, and it's now become vegetables and fruits, and that has just continued to become more robust because it's fun to show people how they can even take some of those wholesome foods and make them the center of the plate, as opposed to, you know, always feeling like they have to have a protein or a meat item on the center of the plate. Let's make more of a cauliflower steak. And so we've added some really new fun ideas for embracing those good wholesome ingredients again.
Well, and that's something that you've also observed, Ruth, is the shift from having that large, and of course many Americans eat this way still, but there is a shift from having that large piece of meat at the center of the plate, right?
And you know, I think if you go back into the dietary guidelines, and even as Jan pointed out earlier when she looked at the 1930s cookbook, we've always talked about moderate portions of meat. However, you know, what actually happened in a lot of instances is there was a preference for larger portions. You know, it wasn't a guideline or it wasn't a nutrition recommendation, but there was this preference. I mean, I think we can all remember there's been a couple of fast food giants that have come out with pound burgers. Mm-hmm. The most recent one I looked up, went back and Googled and tried to find it. You know, it was a pound burger that had almost 1,500 calories in it, and it had over 100 grams of fat in one yeah. burger. And, you know, that was not a nutrition recommendation. But again, that's where some of the consumer preferences have driven what is being offered by the food industry. It's not that it was a, you know, a recommendation or what you would see in maybe the dietary guidelines, but it's where consumer preferences have driven some of what you've seen in the marketplace. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the plate now, you know, half the plate we're looking at fruits and vegetables, and about a little less than a quarter of it as your protein source, and the other quarter on your whole grains. The balance between all the food groups, the moderation, the variety.
Well, we've also seen a huge shift in options that don't have meat. I mean, back 30 years ago, an option that didn't have meat either had a lot of cheese, and not even 30 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I mean, we are doing so much more with vegetables and grains today. And Jan, that's something else that you see in the cookbook, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've had quinoa in the cookbook for a few editions, and maybe we're a little bit ahead of our time. And I'm constantly amazed because we pay attention to the food trends, and sometimes mainstream America is a little bit slower to catch up with us. But I am so excited about we continue to expand the number of grains that we have to shoot, because we try to photograph the picture of the grain so people know what to look for if they're not familiar. And we continue to expand that chart every edition. And the other thing that I love that we're expanding, and it goes back to the last call as well, is that canning is continuing to really grow among the young folks coming up here. They're wanting to do things like their grandparents did, and they're also wanting to capture quality ingredients at the peak of the season and hang on to those for, you know, through the winter. And our canning section in this book continues to grow as well. And you may see some fermenting next edition.
Well, and that's something else that we're seeing in restaurants as well, Ruth. I mean, there are many more plant-based options.
Yes, yes. There's definitely a growing trend towards, more of the fruits, the vegetables, the whole grains, because that's what our message has been. We're trying to encourage increasing the portion of the plate that is being encompassed by those particular food groups. And as Jan mentioned, the canning thing, we have also noticed that here at Extension, that there's a growing interest in the canning, and we want to make sure that people are doing it safely.
Yes.
Because we've had some interesting stories of how Grandma used to do it, and knowing what the recommended method is as far as keeping it safe for your family to actually eat. And so we would always encourage folks who are interested in doing that, make sure that you get proper education. Extension offers a program on how to do home food preservation and canning. Make sure you're doing it in a safe manner. And don't do it thinking that you're going to save money. It's really not about saving money if you're doing home food preservation. It's more about knowing where you got your produce from and how it was handled post-harvest and how it was processed. So if you're approaching it from the standpoint, I want to know where my food's coming from, I want to take responsibility for the processing, that's great. Do it safely. It is a growing area of interest.
We do follow USDA guidelines. I just have to add that,
because
we know how crucial that is.
And
my hair stands on end as I hear people canning in their ovens. Please don't can in your ovens.
Correct. Yeah, do not can asparagus in your oven overnight.
No.
It does not work. And if you are seeking out, you look for a USDA certified recipe for home food preservation. They do have a number of resources, or University of Georgia has an excellent home food preservation resource on their website as well.
Now, here's an interesting perspective from the restaurant world. This is an email from Matt Steigerwald, who was the proprietor of the Lincoln Cafe in Mount Vernon. He said, "We had to start with steak and potatoes at the Lincoln Cafe in 2001, but by 2014, we and any good restaurant needed to put far more interesting foods out there to stay relevant, even in Iowa." I'd love to hear more about that evolution. Ruth?
You know, we have taste buds that have expanded beyond the borders of our state, beyond the borders of this country. We've talked about how food has become more globally available. That's one of my concerns when there's talk about we need to go back to all local regional food systems. No one should be consuming food that's grown outside of 150 miles of their home because of the cost of the transportation and the petroleum and gas. But my concern is that we've all experienced the availability of having fresh berries in the middle of the winter. I don't think we would see too many bananas on the shelf if we were restricted to something grown within 150 miles. And so, I am concerned when I hear some of those comments, because I don't think consumers are willing to go back to the winters where at the grocery store your fresh produce was an apple that was available. You know, our taste buds have expanded both ethnically and just in the diversity of the produce that we now have available to us. But some of that cannot be grown locally. And so, you know, there's going to be that discussion and that trade-off of local versus, you know, variety. And I think we need to think about that.
We have a tweet. We asked people on Twitter to share with us some of the foods that they eat that their parents wouldn't have eaten. This one's from Sarah. She says, quinoa, lentils, Greek yogurt, curry sauce from jars, more spices. And then she said, hippie food. But there is a demand for many more flavors. And we were talking earlier about how ethnic food has become so much more available in Iowa and, of course, everywhere. But also this idea of using more spices and more flavors that go way beyond salt and black pepper in all of our food. Jan, I'm sure that's something that you've seen change the recipes.
Absolutely. I would say the two threads that we hear back from our readers right now is I do want to serve healthful things to my family. And then we also get the, you know, I want to explore flavor. And so all of our, I would say every publication that we're doing on Newsstand now includes some element of a global story. And it's fun to teach about, you know, new seasonings that, and that's what's important for us, I guess, is we do try to give an example of how to use a new seasoning and then also try to give a backup for what you might recognize more readily if you don't have that and you're not feeling that adventurous. But certainly we, like Ruth said, our taste buds have become more experienced, you know, and we're getting to taste more things out of the realm of our usual ho-hum. And so that's part of our job, too, is to help facilitate that so that you can recreate those things in your home.
Now, one of the things that I've observed over the years with the nutritional information, all these studies that get published and all these articles that get written, Ruth, is that we seem like we always feel like we've figured it out. And then a couple of years later, we realize that we didn't have it figured out. And here's new information. Do you feel like we're getting there? Do we have it figured out now?
You know, I don't think we have it totally figured out yet. As I mentioned earlier, you know, nutrition is a new science. You know, it's less than 100 years old. There's so much to learn about it. But what I think all the research helps contribute to the body of evidence and knowing where we need to head. But I think what we need to be careful about is taking that one study or that small group of studies that seem to allude to some new miracle or some new easy fix. And I think that's the biggest thing that I would like to say is there is no, quote, easy fix to all of the ails of society. And I think we really need to get back to the basics of, I can't say it enough, the moderation and a variety of the different food groups. That's really the key, and not to get swayed off into these venues far left and far right, but really it's that balance and moderation in the middle that I think is going to carry you in the long run.
Ruth Litchfield, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University. Jan Miller, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jan Miller is Executive Food Editor at Better Homes and Gardens Special Interest Publication. She's the editor of the Better Homes and Gardens Cookbook, which, of course, is a kitchen staple and has been since 1930. And Iowa Week continues on Talk of Iowa and River to River today. On River to River, a look at healthcare through the years with mental health and childhood diseases. That's coming up today at noon on River to River. All this week, we'll be talking about Iowa then and now, and we're having an Iowa celebration on Thursday in Iowa City at Terry Trueblood Recreation Area. We're having the Great Iowa Potluck, so we would love for you to join us for that. You can find out more information and RSVP at iowapublicradio.org, but please bring a dish to share and come enjoy music and trivia and a whole lot of fun. It starts Thursday at 5 in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.